Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. I'm very happy to speak with you and sit with you today. I'm founder of the Open Heart Project, if we haven't met. And if you're just joining, because we practice together in the 10% Happier 21-Day Meditation Challenge, especially a special welcome to you. And this is the first of an 8-video series on what is called the Noble Eightfold Path. And I'm going to give 8 short talks. This is the first one. And then we'll practice together for 10 minutes. I'll guide us through meditation practice. And I thought it would be a good way to start the year, or a good way to meet each other if we have not met. Because it's been something. I was going to say it's been quite a year, it's been quite a week, it's been quite a day, but all of those things are true. In some sense, it feels like this is the longest day. As I make this on January 15th, it feels like we've been in a single day for like the last 6 months. So thank you for being willing to meditate. Thank you for being willing to look at your mind and soften your heart and do the things that happen through a meditation practice. These are not small things. I thought it would be useful to investigate the principles behind this potent practice called mindfulness, or mindfulness meditation, or the practice of insight, or aka sitting there doing nothing but breathing. All of those things are in some way synonymous. Why is this so powerful? Why does this change everything? These are questions of great interest to myself and others. So let's look at that. Why? Why is it so powerful? You're sitting there. You're not doing anything, literally. You're breathing. When you get distracted, you come back. Why does that lead to greater insight? Why does that lead to more profound compassion? Why does that give you courage? Because these are the results of meditation practice. Wisdom, compassion, and power, sometimes called, other times called confidence or courage. How does that happen? So in recent years, decades, I'd say at this point, there have been an unending stream of really useful scientific studies that say, you know, all those things you thought were good about meditation? I'm science. I'm calling you. I'm telling you, you were right. They're good. Blood pressure, pain, stress reduction, happiness, science, thank you very much, says you're right. So that's very helpful and useful and interesting. There are other helpful, useful, and interesting things, too, that come not from the past decades, but from the past millennia, 2,500 years, I would say, of history behind this practice, says it is going to make you more wise, meaning more clear, more insightful. It will make you more compassionate, which doesn't mean being nice. It means being awake and paying attention so you know what to do. I'm not sure how compassion got conflated with being nice, but that's a subject for another time. And it will give you courage. It will make you more genuine. And being genuine and courageous are the same thing. How does that happen? So to begin to answer that very briefly, because no one can really answer those questions. We're going to look at what's called the Eightfold Path, 8 reasons why this practice is awesome, 8 things you can do that to further emphasize the benefits and to have confidence that you're on a spiritual journey altogether. So, what are these 8 things? We're going to look at the first one today, but first a little history. The Noble Eightfold Path, there are a lot of numbers in Buddhism. If you haven't noticed, you will certainly notice today, is the Noble Eightfold Path is actually the 4th of the 4 Noble Truths. The Buddha, as according to the story, did all the spiritual practices of his day, including extreme asceticism, yogic disciplines, all the things. And they were helpful. But he knew that he was still trapped in the cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. He was trapped in suffering, even though he learned a lot. I'm sure we can all relate to that to some degree. So one day he said, okay, I'm just going to sit here under this tree, now called the Bodhi tree, B-O-D-H-I, Bodhi means awake, until I am liberated. So that is what he did. And according to different stories, different amounts of time went by, but at a certain point, he woke up. And there were all sorts of obstacles thrown in his way by what are called Maras, M-A-R-A-S, like distracting, difficult energies. Perhaps you've encountered such energies in your life. And the Maras tried everything to throw the Buddha off his game, including throwing things at him that get me to move, making horrible weather, making terrible odors. And it finally, and he was like, I'm not moving. And finally they started to shoot arrows at him. But again, according to the story, the Buddha's meditative equanimity was such that as the arrows approached him, they turned into flowers and dropped at his feet. So his meditative equanimity was such that it had the power to turn weapons into sources of beauty and love. We could use some of those. And then he attained enlightenment, and he was like, I've attained enlightenment. And he went back to join his spiritual community, and they said, something's different. And he said, yeah, I've attained enlightenment. And they're like, do tell. He said, I got four things to tell you. First noble truth, life is suffering. Now, suffering, I have been told, is not necessarily the best translation of the Sanskrit word dukkha. I think it's Sanskrit, it might be Pali. Dukkha is perhaps better translated as unsatisfying. Life is unsatisfying. Although there are certainly moments of vast satisfaction, and I hope you will have countless such moments today and for the rest of your life, but the reason things are unsatisfying is because nothing is permanent. Everything changes. There's nothing exempt from this truth. Not a hair on your head, not a feeling in your heart, not a brick in the wall, not a legislative bill on the docket, nothing. Nothing is permanent. Everything changes. Sometimes that's really good. Mostly not, because we think, well, I gotta get my situation in hand. If I have this relationship, if I have this bank balance, if I have this degree, if I have this point of view, if I have this entree into this group, things will be good for me. And you may be absolutely right, but they're not going to absolve you of the suffering that comes with being human. So we do all sorts of things. I personally have done probably half a dozen things or more today to get away from this reality that everything's changing all the time. So that's number one. Number two is called the cause of suffering. What makes it like this? So the cause of suffering, the second noble truth says, grasping is the cause of suffering, which means in some sense, acting like the first noble truth isn't true and trying to hold on to what we want and push away what we don't want. Both can be very practical and wise things to do, but in the uber sense, the ultimate sense, they do not provide a safeguard. But still we act like, well, if I just had this and if I just had that and if I could, grasping actually causes suffering, which is interesting because the Buddha wasn't saying suffering causes suffering, because we all have those things, loss and disappointment, grief, so many things happen to us as human beings, in addition to all the fantastic things. But we cannot hold on to any of them. And that actually causes the deeper suffering. There's suffering, and there's the suffering of suffering. So in some sense, the second noble truth is saying the suffering of suffering is the cause, what we add to our suffering. And then the third noble truth is called the cessation of suffering. Getting to the good news, y'all. Which says, well, now that you know the cause, you also know the cure. Just stop doing that. Just stop doing that. It hurts when I go like this. Okay, don't go like this, is the sort of TLDR version of it. Stop grasping and I won't be suffering. Yeah. Noted. How do you do that? Fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path. Do these eight things and you will no longer be subsumed by grasping. And then you will no longer be suffering. And then you'll be liberated. That's really good news. And not just for you, but your liberation is good news for me too. Because it matters. It changes things. With each moment of liberation we experience, something healthy is, I'm trying to find the right word, extended to the world. So our practice is not just for ourselves, and I'm not saying that to be nice, because I'm not particularly nice, not any more or less than anyone else. I'm saying that because it's true. It's true. When you relieve your suffering, that has great impact on me, and vice versa. So we practice for so many reasons. Okay, so what are these eight things? Now we're getting to the meat of the matter. The first one is called right view, or sometimes translated as right understanding. So it means you got to see things clearly. Otherwise, all the other things you do in your journey, spiritual, psychological, financial, familial, it's going to be planted in the wrong field. So this is like the ground, is having the right view, seeing things clearly. So what does that mean in the Buddhist view? What is the right view in the Buddhist view? So many things. It means some sense of contemplating the first three of the Four Noble Truths and going, oh yeah, those things are real. Let me learn some more about them. But another way of explaining right view is not helpful, but I'm going to do it anyway. So often in the world of spirituality, we're presented with, or in the world of making meaning in our lives, we're presented with two extreme views. The first view, sometimes called eternalism, says, oh, just do all the right things now, and then after you're dead, you're going to get some rewards. That may be true. I don't know, because I'm not dead. Nonetheless, there are a lot of guidance and advice and systems and schools of thought that say, do all these good things, which is always a good idea, and then you're going to get a reward that will be perpetual. You'll be in heaven. You'll be in a God realm. You'll be relieved of suffering later, reunited with all those you love, and there will be no more parting. There will be no more sorrow. I don't know. That's one view. Eternal happiness. The other view is do what you do. Try to be as happy as you can and do the best you can and be a good person and bring happiness to yourself and others or not, because it kind of doesn't matter, because after you're dead, you're dead, and it's gone. So you have choices. You can try to just be a good stand-up person because that seems better, or not, because that seems better. But it doesn't really matter what you do. That's called nihilism or nihilism. So those are sort of two primary, we often think, well, I got to choose one of those. Either some school of thought is going to help me get somewhere good later, forever and ever and ever, or BS, and just do the best I can. And Buddhism says no, no. You may have heard sometimes Buddhism is called the middle way. And what that refers to, in some sense, is not this, not that, right down the middle. Right down the middle. So right down the middle doesn't mean a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It means something else. And a huge part of the spiritual journey is to figure out what that means. You got to figure it out. There are lots of books and stuff, and I'll do what I can to help. But you have to find the right view. What is true? What is true? So it's very important before you sit on a cushion or chair or tell other people what they should do, certainly, or adopt a point of view. It's very important to investigate. It's very important to not take any damn thing I'm saying for, don't take what I'm saying for granted. Don't take what I'm saying. Don't believe anything that I'm saying, or anyone else for that matter. You have to figure it out. And the way to do that is to listen to what you're interested in. Listen to teachers, teachings, books, and then think about it, aka contemplate it, which means let it roll around in your system, in your being. Is that true? When I believe that, or when I think that, how does that inform my actions? And when I don't, how does it inform my actions? Does my experience corroborate that? That's the second step. First step is called hearing. Second step is called contemplating. Third step is called meditating, although it doesn't mean the formal practice that we're fixing to do. Here, meditating means, okay, someone told you something. You thought about it. You checked it against your experience. You corroborated it. Now you do it. That's the third step. Meditation here means do it. You bring it into your life and you actually do it. If this is like, oh, I don't corroborate that, then cool. You don't have to ever think about it again. Don't worry about it. So right view, not eternalistic, not nihilistic, requires your intelligence to even come to a conclusion about what that might mean. And the way you come to a conclusion is by really hearing what's being said and then contemplating it by thinking about it, by checking it. This seems true in this situation, not in that. And then if it is corroborated, that's not enough. Then you do it. And now it's your wisdom. Now you have right view in your heart. And no one can take it from you. So that's the first step. That's the first step. I'll just close by saying that right view, this is sort of a summary of all the many words I just said, is what you know is true. You. So you're the boss of you. I hope this is useful. Next week, in 2 weeks, the second video will come, and it will be on the second of the Eightfold Path, Right Intention. These first two, Right View and Right Intention, are considered a pair within the Eightfold Path. These are the steps that lead to wisdom. The second three, Right Speech, Right Action, Right Livelihood, refer to ethical conduct. And then the remaining three, which we'll also get to, refer to mental discipline. So between these three, genuine wisdom, ethical conduct, and mental discipline, you have what you need to transcend the cycle of suffering and attain liberation. Keep me posted. And in the meantime, let's sit. Begin your practice by taking a good posture, which means sit up straight, Whether you're on a cushion on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, or in a chair. And if you sit in a chair, please sit with your feet flat on the floor. And take a good posture means sit up straight, or your version of straight, depending on you. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And they're just resting. Let yourself feel heavy from the waist down, rooted and strong, and light from the waist up, aspiring and uplifted. Feel the strength of your back body supporting you and the softness of your front body. Let your belly soften a lot. The area around your heart. Let your shoulders relax. Sometimes I have a sense of pulling forward, like I want to accomplish something here. I want to get somewhere. Cool, but those are not necessary right now. So if you have any sense of ambition, and you feel that in your body at all, let go and just let yourself settle back evenly on the cushion or chair. No place to go. In our practice, I have a friend, meditation teacher, who often says, we're not trying to get anywhere. We're trying to be somewhere. That's the magic potion. So be here. The mouth is closed. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, unless you have a cold. In my practice, the eyes are open and the gaze is cast down to a spot in front, up to 6 feet or 2 meters. If you would rather sit with your eyes closed, that's up to you. Otherwise, feel free to experiment or just join me with an open eyes practice, knowing that we are practicing being awake, and it is helpful in that effort to have your eyes open. And let the gaze be soft, and rather than laser focusing, let there be a sense of, what can you see in the whole visual field, end to end? So there's a sense of vision not shooting from the eyes, but rather mixing with space, if that makes sense. If not, ignore. So the eyes are soft. And the crown of the head reaches up a little bit, while the sit bones continue to reach down. So down, up, soft, strong. We can find all of those qualities here in our meditation practice, inseparable from each other. Now let your attention rest on the breath, which does not mean notice the breath. It means feel the breath. Feel your body breathing. There's a gentle expansion on the inhale and a kind of letting go on the exhale, a dissolve. At the end of the exhale, there's a little gap, a space, a rest, musically speaking. And then the next inhale just happens, I promise. And you just go with that, feeling this inhale, this exhale, a little gap, and again, just breathing. Your mind will continue to make thoughts, of course, because that's what it does. Just like your eyes see or your ears hear, the mind thinks. There's no off switch for these things, and nor does there need to be. The great majority of your thoughts will just come and go. You can imagine they're like clouds in the sky. Some are heavy and dark. Some are wispy and light. Beautiful, fluffy, whatever they may be. One by one, they all pass through. And in this practice, we don't identify with the clouds. We identify with the sky, which can hold it all, has no preference, and is always clear and bright and somewhere spacious and easeful. So you don't have to do anything about the clouds slash thoughts, only if you notice you got on a cloud and you rode away, meaning you became absorbed in a line of thought to the point where you forgot about your breath. That's the only time you want to intercede. First, good job. Very good to wake up and see where your mind is. So the first step is you notice that. Say to yourself silently, thinking. That's thinking. It's different than meditating. And then let go. And the letting go is a very gentle gesture, as opposed to elbow out of the way or chop off or whatever. You just let go. Like you open a closed fist and a feather just blows away. Let go. Then come back to the breath and take a fresh start. This inhale, this exhale. And it doesn't matter how many times or how few times you have to do that. The only thing that matters, please believe me, is that you come back, is that you apply the technique as best you can. And I'm sitting here doing the same exact thing. So let's sit together for a few minutes in silence, and there'll be a little gong to indicate the end of the meditation. To close our practice, I want to share with you a few words from a poem written by Rumi, I think the 13th century poet, who said, and this relates to right view, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. This practice takes place in that field. That field is the field of right view. So if you have any sense of, am I doing this right? Or how do I know if it's working? Or when am I going to get somewhere? Totally reasonable questions. Please remember that this practice takes place beyond right doing and wrong doing in a field of much greater and more vast possibility. So thank you so much for your practice. It's important. Thank you for practicing with me. I feel it. And thank you for practicing together. This is an incredible community of practitioners all over the world, and I'm very happy to be a part of it with you. See you in a few weeks.